Tune everyone, you're listening to the Post Bougie Podcast for the weekend, or the week of November 21st, 2010. If we sound different, it's because we're actually all at the same table for the first time. Well, not all of us, but most of us. I'm here with Nicole.
Hi.
Jamel.
Howdy.
And Monica.
Hello.
This is GD, Post Bougie's proprietor. We are in DC in Monica's apartment, so everyone else is drinking, so this might be a lively one.
We just had chicken.
On today's podcast, we're going to talk about two things. We're going to talk about the new study about the achievement gaps, particularly as it pertain to black boys who lag behind just about everyone. And we're also going to talk about a spate of food bans, whether they're effective or whether they're even ethical. Jamel wrote this great post on the American Prospect this week about the study that came out in which black boys lag behind just about everybody. Even when you control for poverty, black boys were outpaced by white boys who are also poor. White boys, poor white boys scored a 33% proficiency in reading, but poor black boys scored at just 11% proficiency. Those are both bad numbers, and they both kind of point to this long trend of boys underperforming, but the number for black boys has been really gotten a lot of attention.
So, yeah, the interesting thing about the report or the study was that even when you adjusted for income, performance for black boys is well below that of their white counterparts. So, middle income or high income. Or middle income, more likely, middle income. Black boy was as likely to do as well as a low-income white kid, which essentially meant that, like, they were underperforming relative to their income.
A low-income white boy.
Right, like, low-income white boy. And so I just wrote a quick post, sort of like, it was more like a lament than anything else, sort of noting how there are a lot of things that go into, like, creating underperformance among African-American kids in general and African-American boys in particular. It's not just that, you know, African-American kids are more likely to go to segregated schools, like, effectively segregated schools, without the resources or, you know, expertise in terms of the teaching staff to succeed. But they're more likely to live in neighborhoods that lack sort of human capital resources. Like, they're less likely to know a professor or a lawyer or a teacher. They're less likely to have access to libraries. They're less likely just to have access to everything that, like, adds to a child's education, but isn't necessarily in the classroom.
And even if they are of higher income, they're more likely to live closer to neighborhoods that are like that, or to areas that are like that.
For reasons that make a lot of sense when you think about them, right? That, first, the majority of middle-class African-Americans don't actually come from the professional class. They are lawyers, doctors, etc. They're nurses, teachers, social workers on the lower end of the middle-class scale. As such, they're more likely to live in mixed-income neighborhoods and more likely to have sort of geographic proximity and, like, social relationships with people lower on the income scale as they are. And so, whereas, you know, a white kid growing up in a, you know, middle-class neighborhood, his social connections might include a professor, a lawyer, and thus that shapes his expectations, shapes his thoughts of what he could do, and also shapes his opportunities. A comparably placed income-wise black kid might, in addition to having teachers and nurses in his or her, you know, social circle, someone who just did time. Someone who never finished high school. And this also, like it would for, you know, the hypothetical white kid, affect their expectations, affect their opportunities, and the whole nine yards. So I was sort of just, like, noting all of that and then saying, you know, because it's so complex, because trying to solve this problem requires attacking, you know, a whole host of things that you really couldn't possibly attack using government policy, the most likely outcome is that we're going to try something, it's not going to work, it's not comprehensive enough, and we're just going to give up. We're going to say, we've already tried, anti-poverty spending. We've already tried affordable housing. We've already tried trying to improve the schools. So forget it.
But I think what was most interesting to me, too, is that it seems like completely and totally relatable to the very particular prejudice that black men face in society as well. I mean, I think it's like so clearly explained by that, that it's hard to attack this pervasive racism that describes low-income black men as criminal,
right,
and, you know, underworking. And those are stereotypes that particularly pertain to black men and have forever, that I wonder if it's really something you can attack with social policy, or if it's something that's just so pervasive in society that you have to do something more drastic than
Yeah, this is absolutely the thing that's so crazy, is that, like, this is, like, a crisis, but, like, no one will... I mean, it's also kind of, like, the latest in the... Like, every month it seems like there's, like, some study that says that black men have it really fucking bad, right? And so, like, if you just expect all these, like, horrible outcomes, like, black men are kind of are disproportionately, like, headed to all these, like, horrible inevitabilities, then, like, you know, I think a lot of people just, like, don't, there's never really going to be, like, any kind of motivation on a society, like, society-wide level to fix those things. If it's just assumed that, I think a lot of it is that a lot of people think that black men do it to themselves, right?
Right.
If this is something that we could just change if we all just...
Pull our pants up and
right, I mean,
making proper
that's,
English.
That's how the conversation... Right. Absolutely.
Just not buying a rap CD.
And that's how the conversation goes.
Yeah.
Right? Is that like...
Jay-Z junk. Throw it to Miles Davis.
Absolutely. Well, and suddenly everyone will be reading proficiently.
Well, we were talking about this earlier, too, that the kind of differences between urban and rural poverty, and one of the most striking differences, I think, with urban poverty is just how much contact people have with police when they're poor and they live in cities, and I think that's particularly true of black men. And so while somebody who lives in rural poverty faces real challenges that I don't want to undermine, the truth is that I think, like, a really heavy police presence that feels as though the state has all its power against you has to just weigh really heavily on anything that you would ever do.
Yeah, so there's, a friend Talia was just here a second ago. She wrote a story for, she still worked for the Providence Journal, and she wrote a story a few months ago specifically about how Rhode Island was trying to deal with disproportionate minority contact for juvenile offenders. Like, there's not a lot of black people in Rhode Island, but
right,
if you look at the juvenile justice system there, like, it's overwhelmingly black and brown. And so it's kind of like...
The same is true of Connecticut as well.
Right, Connecticut, like, where Monica used to work as well. It's like, so these are not like, it's not as if, these are populations that commit about, like, proportional amount of crime. I mean, like, if you're a drug offender, it's not because, like, more black people use drugs or sell drugs than white people do, than proportionally speaking. But, like, everyone in jail is, like, who's in jail on drug offenses is fucking black. Sorry, is black. And so, like, and so, like, there's this, like, very early criminalization of, like, there are all these things that happen to black men, black boys. Like, there's the studies that came out that said that, like, black boys would get, like, at the same school as white boys would get, like, harsher treatments for the same, like, the same kind of behavior. Like, the
right,
same kind of,
right,
like, you know, they're more likely to be, like, sentenced more harshly or suspended from school for, you know, the same stuff that white boys would get passes for. Like, there's this very, and you can't really wrap your hands around, like, get your arms around that issue specifically, because people are discriminating in these ways, and they don't even...
Yeah, it's hard to call it discriminating, because discriminating implies some sort of intentionality.
Right,
to
absolutely.
It. But it's just, like, cultural, like, there are cultural attitudes that, like, people just absorb, and so when a teacher sees that they're black, sees, like, their white kid acting up, they're just like, oh, boys will be boys.
Boys will be boys.
But they've absorbed this attitude that, like, you know, black kids are just going to be, like, disruptive, and, like, oh, they're not going to amount to anything anyway.
Mm.
And they may not even really be conscious
of
making this,
right,
just, like, it's there.
Mm.
They're, like, primed to believe it. And
right,
so a black kid acts up, and they're just, like, to the principal's office, suspended.
Absolutely.
And yeah, like, black boys are just, you know, from the moment from the moment they enter school, are interacting with authority in ways that's really, really detrimental and negative. Because it's not just that, like, they are, you know, being suspended and being like accustomed, acclimated to being treated unfairly. But, you know, part of succeeding, part of navigating sort of middle-class life is knowing when to respond to authority and when not to. Mm. And so you have a generation of kids who not only have this very oppositional view of authority, which only hurts them.
Mm.
Like, you know, that's a middle class value they don't actually have.
Right.
So it just hurts them further down the line. Mm. When they're trying to get a job, or when, you know, a boss criticizes them and their first response is to respond negatively.
Right.
Because, you know, why not? Authority has always treated you like that.
I think we should talk a little bit about the inequality at birth, though. Like, you start out behind, like, literally the moment you were born.
Right.
For a variety of reasons. I mean, there are things that you can't necessarily... Like you said, things that... There's no way that we're going to have a social policy that's comprehensive enough to fix it. But, like, things like you're more likely to be born into an area that, like you said, is either in poverty or close to poverty. You're more likely to be born with just less resources than, you know, a comparable kid. And a comparable kid of another race, or even specifically when you're talking about urban areas in a suburban place. Oh. And I think it's important to remember that as well, although it sort of starts to, that's when I get depressed and I'm like, okay,
right.
Well, now this is becoming a really big problem and I don't know what to do about it. And like, right. How do you even begin to attack that when, like, from the moment literally, you know, you're born, you've already started out behind, like you're already behind the curve.
To use a concrete example, you know, precisely because African-Americans have a lower rate of college attendance and graduation, like, your average black kid is likely to be born to parents who didn't graduate from college and are likely to have a smaller vocabulary. And so you're not hearing as many words as, like, the comparably placed white kid, which that alone affects your educational attainment over the long term.
Yeah.
Like, the fact that your mom uses 1,000 or 2,000 words fewer than some other mom puts you behind before you even had a chance to start.
Yeah, and programs that try to deal with this, is especially in like Louisiana, which Catherine Boo, who I think is our hero, wrote about years ago in Louisiana, and that was for both poor black and white kids.
Yeah,
that put nurses in homes of like teenage mothers and low income mothers, and basically the idea, as Catherine Boo put really succinctly, was to give those kids better parents than they would have otherwise. Those really start to butt up against some uncomfortable truths, and that's that we have the state dictating how parents should be parents. And that's something that's true of like really good programs like the Harlem Children's Zone as well, which I like, but what you have is a program that teaches parents how to be parents and says the middle class way that parents is better than the way that you were going to parent.
Right.
And that's a value judgment that we've decided that kind of super interactive, achievement-oriented way of parenting is better than letting kids socialize on their own, letting kids work out their own social structures, letting kids just be kids, which starts to be uncomfortable for me after a certain point.
Yeah, I mean, one of our colleagues at the American Prospect, Adam Serber, made this point, and that is, you know, the school he went to would stay in until 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock at night. And part of that was simply because a lot of these kids came from homes that you didn't want them going back to. So keeping them in school until 9 o'clock at night was keeping them around adults who genuinely cared about them in a way they weren't getting at home. And, you know, yeah, at a certain level, it's uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, to think that we have a population that in the aggregate is, like, so dysfunctional that, like, what might work is simply substituting parenting, like, using the force of government to, you know, parent these kids. And it just flies against everything we believe, like, everything that's, like, deep in, you know, our beliefs as Americans, that, you know, at a certain point, government just shouldn't intervene in this.
Right.
But, you know... But
we've arguably gotten to the point where what else do you have left?
Right, like what else?
The alternative is literally just writing off a group of kids
and
saying, well, sorry.
The alternative is a permanent underclass.
Right.
I mean, you know, one of the really depressing things about the recession is how, you know, it's hit African-American Latino populations really hard. I think the average unemployment rate among both hovers around 15%.
Which is depression.
That is depression-level unemployment. And if you look at sort of individual towns and localities, a good example was Cadillac, Michigan. Cadillac.
That's the French word. Spanish word, rather.
Cadillac, Michigan, which has never, I mean, for the last decade, has not been in a great place economically. But, you know, during the course of the recession, it's gone from a place where there's already high 15-16% unemployment to 32-33% unemployment.
Unreal.
A third of the adults in this town or in this city don't have jobs.
Right.
And so if they're unemployed, it means one thing to be unemployed for a month or two. If you're unemployed for a year or two in a low-skill industry, then you really can't go back to work after that.
Mm-mm.
And so what's happening in, like, towns and cities across the country are, you know, large numbers of people who don't have a job to go, who even if the economy recovers, won't have a job to go back to, and are the social safety net in this country isn't strong enough to account for them.
Right.
So they just become, they're just there. And what do you do about that?
Absolutely. Yeah. And so, yeah, so we're talking about, you know, these, like, permanently high rates of unemployment, but, like, so you can't fix that without, like, talking about incarceration. And so, like, there's, like, all these things that affect black men, like you were saying before, that are kind of inextricable from each other. Like, you can't talk about, you know, unstable communities if you're not talking about incarceration. And you can't talk about, you know, you can't talk about schools. And you can't, like, I mean, it's just not, you, it's, John McWhorter had a piece, was it The Root? I think it was The Root, about, he was talking about the methodology of teaching young kids that had proven to be really successful, and that it was teacher-proof, he said, which is obviously, like, John McWhorter tipping his little tip of the hat to, you know, teacher-proof, because teachers are idiots, right? Because John McWhorter is a lightweight asshole, and so he has to, whatever, but, he's, like, doing his little, you know, like, conservative. So, you know, like, and I think, you know, there was a story on The Root as well about single-sex schools for black boys and how, like, one school had, at least their early results were really, really positive. And, like, so there's all these ideas that, like, if we just do these things, we can, like, you know, if we just have single-sex charter schools for black boys that are really intensive, and we just change these things here and there, then we can improve the lives of young black boys. But it's never, it can't be, I mean,
yeah,
those things will work for a couple hundred black kids here and a couple hundred black kids there. But, like, if we're talking about, like, a broad-based, none of those things are scalable, really.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so, like, all the stuff we need to do is really, really, really intensive, like, policy stuff. But there's, like, there's no political will to do so.
Yeah, there's no constituents. I mean, yeah, there's no one rich enough or powerful enough who's going to lobby on behalf of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
I feel like I would be remiss not to talk about gender, though, here, because, like, this is a trend that something that women have been noticing for some time is that men, both black and white, are underperforming academically compared to women and have been for some time. Women are already earning more bachelor's degrees and more advanced degrees and still continue to earn less in the workplace. And so that's a really interesting phenomenon that I don't know if we know how to really rip apart if what we have here. And also, when you talk about wealth and income between black men and black men, black men and black women, black men still do better,
yeah,
even though underperforming academically. And right. So that's what I don't understand is where these two things
apart. It is kind of hard to wrap your mind around it, like, you know.
Yeah, and so I'm a big proponent of single-sex education, and, you know, even though schools like Urban Prep, which is the school in Chicago that The Root wrote about, isn't scalable, I think that if we're talking about an underperforming group forming an idea of community that enhances performance, you could do worse than a single-sex, you know, school focused on creating a sense of community that fosters achievement and fosters a sense of support for each other. I think schools like that individually could be good, but on a broad scale, we're still talking about a society that undervalues women in the workplace and undervalues boys in the academic setting. And I don't know how to reconcile those two things or to deal with them in any kind of broad way.
Yeah. I mean, I'm increasingly of the opinion that a lot of these things you're just going to have to attack on the margins. Like, for a variety of reasons, the political system just isn't equipped or isn't willing to actually deal with them. And so it's a matter of just slowly chipping away and hoping nothing gets too far ahead of you that it isn't recoverable.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a really bleak thought.
No, it absolutely is.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think, like, the Paycheck Fairness Act failed this week. And I think a lot of it still has to do with how we think about gender in society. I mean, I think the underachievement of black men in high school and college has a lot to do with stereotypes and racism, and what we have in the workplace has a lot to do with sexism, and these things are sort of culturally intractable. I don't know how to change them through policy.
Yeah,
I don't think you can change them through policy.
Yeah.
But how do you change, then how do we change the mindset then?
Right. I mean, there's just so much. I mean, I remember when the Lily Ledbetter Fair Pay Act.
Really depressing podcast.
I know. I'm just gonna drink some more wine.
Yeah. I remember this is why I'm drinking. I remember when the Lily Ledbetter Fair Pay Act was signed last year.
The first thing Obama signed.
Mm-hmm. Talking to my mom about it, and she actually did not realize that like there is the pay gap remained among men and women.
Mm-hmm.
Like I think you know. To a certain extent, people just aren't aware of it. And I don't really expect them to be. Like, you're trying to do your own thing. You're trying to live your own life. It's hard. Like my life, essentially, is, like, keeping track of public policy stuff. Mm, like,
right.
Not few people could do that, and I wouldn't actually recommend it for you. If you want to stay safe. Right.
I can only support this anecdotally, but I actually suspect that most Americans, if you set them down with a bottle of wine and you talked it through it with them, most Americans would think it's completely and totally fair that women get paid less than men. Because all you have to do is buy the conservative line that this is fueled by women's choices to take care of their children.
Mm.
That seems
true. And those choices have nothing, there's no sort of competence for them. You just decide that's what you're going to do. There's no pressure on you either way.
There's no discrimination that makes that a sane choice.
Right.
Like, I know that my future, if I have children, is probably more dire than if I don't. So if I did have children, it would make more sense for me to take myself out of the workforce than it would for my partner.
Right, which would never,
probably.
If we had like something like paternity leave, which is true in a lot of like European countries, right? So like if we had something like that, you wouldn't see total paycheck parity, obviously. But you would see more so, right? If a woman has two kids and she's taking herself out of the workforce every couple of years, you know what I mean? Like that is a huge.
So we have like not just paternity leave, like mandatory paternity
leave. Right, yeah. Absolutely.
If you had a kid, the husband has to go to the workforce
for four months.
Fatherhood has to be something that is seen as important the way that motherhood is.
Right. Right.
But I mean, I think that that also describes what happens with black men. I mean, the rewards for black men who finish high school and college are much less than the rewards that white men have.
Fantastic point.
And so, like, it makes sense. It's completely rational to not go through that because the rewards aren't as great.
Right. I think Jamal may have blooded this before, but I think like if you are black with a college degree, like you're still way more likely to be unemployed than if than if you're not.
Yeah.
I mean, it's almost as if like that idea that like if having a college degree is like the minimum, if it doesn't guarantee you anything, but it's
class.
If it's it doesn't guarantee you anything, but it's at least like a barrier, like a bus, it's a floor, right?
Yeah.
To like you know what you can expect in your life. That's not true for black men, and so like. Again, it's
not
like,
as true.
Not as true. Yeah.
And in a lot of ways, it can be a detriment. Like, if you're going to be unemployed even with your degree, like, then you're unemployed, presumably with a significant amount of debt.
Mm. And 4 years of opportunity cost.
Right.
Right.
For what?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's something that I see. I grew up in a poor white area. And for the white boys there, it was a detriment to go to college. There wasn't a good job market for boys with bachelor's degrees. Most of the people with bachelor's degrees worked in the education field, and that was mostly seen as a women's field. So going to college for 4 years, not only would you incur debt, but you missed 4 years of earning opportunity during your prime physical peak. So most boys went into construction. It made most sense to do that between the ages of 18 and 50 when you're back.
Body still
out.
Work, right?
You know, and so, you know, it is a completely, I think that's one of the things that conservatives especially miss about poverty and the choices that people make in poverty. They're completely rational.
Yeah.
It's not as though people are deluded and are making stupid choices.
There's some sort of, and I guess I can, on a level, understand where this comes from, but there's a massive assumption, and I don't think it's just a conservative assumption, I think it's a general assumption in this country, that if you're poor, it's because you're stupid, or because you...
No, right.
Yeah.
You don't know how to make the proper choices. Which,
it's very Puritan.
Right, which is not true at all.
And I think, you know, it's worth noting who that view, who is like, you know, putting that view out there. Overwhelmingly, it's educated people, people like educated sort of a middle class mindset. Mm. And so, to me, yes, it's really dumb not to like try to get like a 4 year degree and do something, or at least not try to educate yourself and sort of like move yourself upwards on the income scale. But my calculations, as someone who grew up in like middle class suburbia, are totally different than someone who didn't.
Right.
Like, you know, if I live in a place where the only college-educated guy I know is unemployed, And, you know, I know a bunch of other people working, you know, great jobs, but at least for making money.
Mm.
You know, I'm not, why would I will just, like, not even worry about college. Like, I don't see the material benefits of college.
Mm.
And, you know, I can make a few dollars here. Why not make that choice? And people, no one's a particularly good long-term planner.
Like, right,
if people were good long-term planners, the economic crisis wouldn't have happened. So, I mean, it's not as if it's weird to make this, like, short-term, you know, hyper-rational decision. It's just, you know.
I'm also going to throw this out there, but I don't want to get into this argument because we will be here all night. But this is the same sort of rationale or thinking that goes into starting a family at an age that, you know, if you're from a middle-class background, people might think of as a little ridiculous or insane or not a wise decision.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the same sort of calculation, I think.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm just going to leave it at that.
I want to say also that, like, you know, as much as systems and incentives play a huge role in how people behave, ultimately we are talking about, like, you know, moral actors who can make different choices.
Mm.
And so, like, I think it's a little too easy for liberals to get sort of caught into the very, like, systemic, like, of course people are going to act this way because all the incentives are pushing them that way.
Mm.
And, like, I think that's, like, 70% of the case, but it's also mixing with, like, the other 30% or, like, the other 40%, which is, you know, cultural values,
mm-hmm.
like, you know,
how do you?
It's hard to untangle it,
right? How do you separate the cultural values?
But I just want to, like, I just want to put out there for the listeners,
it's not all your fault. It's not all society's fault.
People aren't mechanic,
right?
But, you know, neither are they totally autonomous
actors. Right? If that were the case, then no one would ever get out of poverty, which is still unlikely, and it's still you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like,
It's
really hard to, like, delineate
between
where the structure
is. And when it comes down to it, like, you know, when it comes down to it, if your operating assumption is that these things are more mechanical than we think, then you're probably going to, like, do things that'll be more helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That, like,
no, you're probably,
like, as far as, like, you know, being accurate researchers are concerned, we should, you know, keep in mind how these things are very tangled. But as far as making policy is concerned, you know, if people don't have enough to eat or, like, good housing, like, let's take care of that.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah, as someone who, like,
hierarchy of needs.
As someone who spent her undergrad ranting against socioeconomic determinism in anthropology, I will say that I think socioeconomic determinism plays a larger role than anything else. Like, these things really interact very closely, but the only thing we have control over is the socioeconomics of it, to a degree. But just to Nicole's point, because I don't think we ever talked about the no wedding, no room thing. Well, we did talk about it, but it didn't.
It makes everyone have a stroke.
We did talk about it, but we didn't air that podcast. But, I mean, the same thing holds true for poor women, by and large, because, you know, biologically it makes more sense to have children earlier on, and if you're always going to be low income, and if you're not going to go to college, it doesn't make any sense to delay. I mean, I think these things hold true for women as well as men, which is why I'd like to see a comparison between poor black women and poor white women, because I suspect that poor white men do better than poor white women, and the reverse is true for poor white men.
Because all of y'all just said no wedding, no womb. But it's like saying Beetlejuice on the podcast. Like, these people are going to harass us for the next week or so. We're going to have to deal with this woman.
You can cut it. I mean, she already still attacks me because she wrote, like, the number one Google search for my name is her.
Congratulations.
I know. I'm really upset.
I'm saying, just so you know.
She really hates me.
She said Candyman in the window a couple of times. This is crazy. Now, but so we're talking about, if we make this jump, so we're talking about systemic issues and the choices people make, we should go to the next issue, which is on food bans.
So I put up a post, like, really quickly about the soda ban, because in New York, Mike Bloomberg floated with the USDA the idea of banning soda or soda-like drinks from food stamps or SNAP, or, like, you can't buy them with your food stamps. It's actually not the first time this idea has been around. I think it was tried in either Wisconsin or Minnesota. They also floated the idea, and the USDA didn't approve it. It would be a trial program. It would just be, like, a year or two to sort of see what happens. So do we want to just start with that, and then we'll move into the other bans? I think that it's a really ridiculous idea. I think that it's stupid. The soda ban. Okay. Like, I mean, granted, there's no nutritional value in soda. Like, none whatsoever.
But it's delicious.
But it is delicious.
I actually can't drink soda anymore. I'm just going to say that. It's, like, way too sweet for me now.
Really?
Yeah.
I do only drink diet soda because regular soda is, like, really sugary.
Yeah, I think that's
because none of you people have heard of cheer wine, but we'll save that
for later. I have.
What is cheer wine?
Cheer wine is the devil's beverage.
Cheer wine is the soda that you can only get in North and South Carolina, and I'm like, the very northern part of Georgia and the very southern...
You can get it in Virginia.
In the very southern rural part of Virginia. And it's sort of vaguely cherry flavored and a little
bit. It's red. It's red drink.
It's red.
Is it like Mr. Pibb is to Dr. Pepper?
No, it's sort of.
It's like cherry flavored in the way that Vanilla Ice is a wrapper.
That's actually a pretty accurate description, I'm going to have to say. It's my favorite thing in the entire world. I'm pretty sure that it has enough sugar in a single can to give you diabetes immediately as soon as you finish it.
It's called cheer wine?
It's called cheer wine because it makes you happy because you were bouncing off the wall.
You got the diabetes.
the sugar.
The sugar, right. It's the sugar.
Cheer wine. Like,
so wait, that's the brand name, cheer wine?
Yeah, the brand name is cheer wine.
There is no generic.
There's no generic. It's cheer wine.
So there's a soda called with wine.
Is this the only soda wine this company makes?
That's a good, I think so, but I'm not sure. They might have been bought by another soda, like the umbrella of...
There's a similar soda up north called Moxie. Which is also really gross.
Never had Moxie.
No,
I have had Moxie. It's disgusting. Moxie is disgusting.
See, you kind of went far afield.
Sorry. The idea of... I mean, people argue that it's taxpayers' money. Like, you should be buying healthy foods with this money. You shouldn't be spending it on crap. I don't buy that argument. I mean, on one level, you can go ahead and say, well, what if you're not buying it all the time and you just want to buy it as a treat? Like, you know, your kid's turning 5 or, well, 5 maybe is not a good age, but like, your kid's turning 10 and you want to buy, like, soda and
cupcakes. It's a child birthday party.
Right, it's a child birthday party and you want to buy soda, like, for a special treat and you're not allowed to do it. It just, the idea of telling people what they can and cannot buy does not sit well with me. And I think this also makes the assumption that if you participated in the Food Stamp program, which, might I add, has grown tremendously in the last couple of years thanks to the recession, that you don't know that soda is bad for you and someone should tell you this is bad for you, so we're just going to not let you take it. Yeah. And then people also compare it to you can't buy alcohol or tobacco with food stamps. I'm not quite prepared to put soda in the same category as alcohol and tobacco, but it just... It makes me really nervous.
I'd also say that, like, if your concern is that poor people might be getting, like, empty calories, well, guess what? There are other sources of empty calories besides soda.
Right.
Like, if you're really intent... It's just like, you know, if you really want to blow up something, it's not hard to do it. If you really want to consume a couple thousand empty calories, there are other avenues besides soda. Mm. And so, like, I think you're right. What ends up happening is, first you're like, oh, we're going to ban soda, so, like, poor people or people on food stamps don't buy things that aren't nutritious. And then you're like, well, let's ban Little Debbie cakes too, because those are pretty much empty calories. Oh, and like, it just cascades into just, it's really like,
it's a very slippery slope.
Yeah, like circumscribing the buying options of poor people because you are uncomfortable with the idea of it being wasted.
And all under the assumption that basically they don't know any better.
Right.
Yeah, I'm of two minds about this. Like, first of all, I would never support it because of that assumption. It feeds the middle class assumption that poor people are poor for a reason. It's because they're stupid and they don't know how to buy the right things and they don't know how to prioritize. That, to me, is why, more than anything, it should be not allowed. At the same time, I think that soda is singularly bad for you. And so, like, if a program is designed to talk about what is nutritious, then I think it's fine to single out soda as particularly unnutritious, because not only is it full of empty calories, but it also doesn't displace hunger. So something like French fries, which aren't particularly good for you, at least make you less hungry.
Yeah.
And so you can eat French fries for lunch and not want more food later on. That is not true of soda. You can drink soda until the end of time. And I just also want to point out that we're not even talking just about Americans in general. Middle-class Americans, too, don't know how bad soda is for you and drink way too much of it.
Everyone drinks way too much.
They drink, the average American drinks 2 sodas a day, which is 300 empty calories.
I mean, this is assuming a 12-ounce can. A 12-ounce can of, let's say, Coke is about 160 calories. So it's like 320 empty calories a day. If we're talking about bottles, which are 2.5 servings, then, like, the average American, if they're drinking 2 bottles of soda a day, is consuming
$500 or $600 extra.
$600 a day.
Let's which not is an extra about mill. The big gulp.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I mean, Americans like are drink. Americans in general drink a mill's worth of calories a day in the form of soda, which doesn't provide any nutritional value whatsoever. And so, for this reason, I support the soda tax, which is like marginally different. So, soda taxes are regressive, like all sales taxes. So I'll just say that right now. And for this reason, progressives get up in arms about it. But regressive just means it hits poor people disproportionately. The vast majority of funds from a soda tax would come from middle class Americans who buy soda.
And if the idea is to sort of like curb soda consumption, then like you actually want this tax to be a little regressive.
Yeah.
Like you if your idea is to get lower income people from stop spending their income on soda, then this is a feature, not a bug.
You also want middle-class people to fund health programs. And so in places like New York, where they proposed a soda tax that failed because of the Pepsi lobby out of Westchester, you get a tax that most of the actual dollars come from middle-class people that fund health programs in the state that primarily go to poor people. That's actually ultimately redistributive.
Redistributive.
Yeah, thank you. Even though the sales tax itself is regressive. So I think progressives get too caught up in individual taxes that are regressive.
I mean, this is the point that, I mean, I know I've made, I'm not sure at TAP, but like in my old blog I've made, and Matt Iglesias makes some occasion, that really, you know, when it comes to taxes and benefits, what's important is how you ultimately, like, distribute the gains from taxes, not mm-hmm. like the actual tax itself.
The whole system is important, yeah. Which I think progressives tend to forget.
Yeah,
I mean, all sales taxes at their base are regressive, but as long as they go to programs that benefit poor people, they're ultimately progressive. I think that you see that's true in like the United Kingdom, where really effectively the tax rate is almost the same for every income group, but programs like the public health system are really a massive redistribution to the poor, because very, very rich people just pay for their own health care in the private system. And so if you have a system that ultimately really supports the very poorest citizens, then it doesn't matter where the taxes come from as much.
Right. I will say, as far as soda taxes are concerned, I think for people who support them, your best case ought to be made for the money you can raise, and not necessarily like changing behavior, because there isn't actually that much, like there isn't that much evidence to suggest that a soda tax would do much to curb people's consumption.
It's actually purchasing soda is very elastic. If you have really?
Let me rephrase that. If your goal is to combat obesity.
Yeah.
Then soda taxes are just deferring those empty calories to another product.
Mm-hmm. Probably, yeah.
Probably. Like, if your goal is to reduce the consumption of soda, sure. If your goal is to make, you know, reduce the incidence of obesity, then you probably should stop trying with the soda taxes.
You have to also make whole healthy foods cheap.
Right.
So just related, because we're talking about a policy that is supposed to change eating habits, Nicole was kind of exercised earlier this week about
the ban. Now we're going to talk about the toy ban. The toy ban. So as you may or may not know, the San Francisco, I forget what the city.
The Board of Supervisors?
The Board of Supervisors, I think. Mm-hmm. Was looking at banning
toys. Which is the equivalent to the city council. The city council.
Right. Was looking at banning the toys and Happy Meals and any sort of, like, fast food kids' meals. Well, it's not quite true. They were looking at banning them unless the nutritional content of the meals was improved. I personally, again, think that this is a terrible idea. But I think it's a bad idea for a different reason. The whole, I guess, goal is that kids really like the toys, so they get really excited about it, and so they really want the Happy Meal, and they're bugging their parents, and
I want a cheeseburger.
Right, they're marketing towards kids. My personal belief is that if you have children, you should be able to tell them no. Therefore, it's not up to the San Francisco Board of Supervisors to be able to say, well, there shouldn't be toys in this because they're marketing towards children, and that's not okay. Like, you just... No, just say no. Like, you can't have this. You can't have this because it's unhealthy. You can't have this because we're going to go home and eat. You can't have this. End of story.
But I think that kind of overlooks how much, like, sway kids have in the kind of decisions that parents make. Like, the kind of, like... I mean, because all these people know that cereal It's like the cereal that gets advertised on Saturday morning cartoons, like really endlessly, and the toys.
Reese's Puffs.
Yeah, I mean, Oreo cereal.
There's no even, part of that that we're not dessert.
Even, like, we're not even fronting like the stuff is like remotely healthy. It's like candy cereal. Like, you know
Cookie
I mean?
Crisp.
Yeah, absolutely.
It actually is candy cereal.
So, like, the reason those products are profitable is because they are marketed to kids, right? I mean, because kids can, like, if you like, Mom, I want this Legos that I saw in those commercials on Saturday morning cartoons, or I want this Cookie Crisp cereal, whatever it is, it's like...
Right, but I'm a parent and you're the child for outweighs. A reason.
If you're a parent, it's like, I can spend $3.50 on a box, or like... Listen to my kid complain.
Right.
Well, I'm a parent and you're the child for a reason. It's up to me to say, no, you can't have that.
So Nicole and I had a fight about this on Google Buzz. I think it's completely within the purview of cities to regulate the ways that companies can market to kids, which is what I see this as. So if McDonald's wants to sell Happy Meals as they exist to kids, it just can't include toys in them anymore. And if kids really want the food, then they'll still be able to get it. Alternatively, McDonald's can start putting a fruit cup instead of fries in its Happy Meals and still sell the toys. And then if kids want the toy and the meal, then they'll get it. So I don't think this is completely onerous on McDonald's to deal with. And I also think that I think that nobody understands a crying kid who wants a toy the way that the parent who finally pulls over to McDonald's does.
Right.
Fuck it. We're just going to get a Happy Meal. I think that's a phrase a lot of parents have said.
Or you thought in their head, at least.
Yeah, and I think that we maybe underestimate the barrage of marketing that kids face.
Yeah.
And how hard that is for all of them to deal with.
I mean, if you're going to start with a Happy Meal, like, where do you stop marketing to children? Like, are we going to go after the cereals next? Like, it's another one of those things that I don't like, because I think it removes... I hate using the word responsibility, because I always feel like that's a concern with everyone's like that. But I feel like it removes the responsibility.
It removes the responsibility. That's the takeaway from this.
I think it
removes responsibility from the parent. Like,
I actually don't have any problem with curbing the way that companies market to kids. They're a completely and totally malleable group of customers that is... over which companies have enormous sway. So
that's
actually...
That's why children have parents!
But I think... Go ahead.
I can see both ends. Like, instinctually, I'm like...
No, you can't equivocate like this. You're either with me or against me.
Do you hate freedom?
I mean, I can both hate freedom and...
Happy Meals.
And happiness. On one hand, I do agree with Monica that this is fundamentally, like, no different than telling a company that it can't advertise... a cigarette using a cartoon figure. That, like, if we recognize that a McDonald's Happy Meal is not actually a healthy thing, that it's something people should avoid eating, just like people should avoid smoking, then there's no reason why, you can't tell McDonald's, well, if you're going to advertise these, you can't use things that are there deliberately to hook kids.
Right.
Mm-hmm. On the other hand, right, ultimately, a parent should be able to say no to their kid. So, a parent should be able to, if the kid really wants a Happy Meal, should be able to say, no, you can't have the commemorative Batman mugs that are coming with your Happy Meal.
That's actually a terrible toy.
It can't be. I want a real thing, Batman Forever. Really? Batman Forever, I think.
You want a posable action figure. I want a mug.
I definitely want a couple mugs.
Oh, that's
the Jim Carrey mug.
Why are you such a toy
Riddler.
Elitist?
I'm not a toy elitist, I'm just saying. Okay, let's move it up a couple years then to college age kids who have been denied their rightful Four Loko.
So next food ban, the FDA apparently is moving now to, or has moved to, ban Four Loko and similar drinks.
I've never even heard about this drink before.
I never had either.
Basically,
because you guys are so unhip.
I think you're unhip for using the word unhip.
This is also true.
They're basically caffeinated alcoholic beverages, sort of like a Red Bull vodka, but all in one can. I may or may not have consumed some Four Loko at a wayward point in my life, like maybe last weekend.
How was it?
It's disgusting. It's absolutely terrible.
What does it taste like?
I have the watermelon one, and it tastes red. I mean, it's like an alcoholic Jolly Rancher. It's really sweet. It has that like weird malt liquor flavor.
Watermelon Jolly Rancher is my favorite.
Malt liquor Jolly Rancher?
Yeah. Like,
that sounds like the most hood shit.
That sounds tailor-made. That sounds like a CIA tailor-made for the ghetto.
Oh my god. They won't be able to resist. What
the hell? I mean, it comes in, like, the big,
I'm late on this. I'm, like, offended after the fact, though.
Yeah, no, I have to say, so, as an old person, I've never had any sort of Red Bull and vodka. Like, Red Bull came out way after college.
I drink them because I'm afraid that I'm going to die.
I'm really glad I didn't stay awake through all of my drunkenness. Like, the only benefit to me getting super drunk in college was that I eventually fell asleep. Right. Like, that's the only thing that stopped me from doing some really fucked up shit.
So is the idea behind the FDA's idea is that the caffeine keeps people from...
awake, and then they drink more, and that makes it more dangerous.
Yeah, the caffeine counteracts the... So when you're drinking a lot, if you're drinking a bunch of whiskeys or bourbons, as I prefer...
In your house coat?
In my house coat, with my...
smoking jacket, but without jacket. The smoking.
Absolutely. On the lawn with bocce balls. if you're just drinking regular alcohol, eventually your body is, like, you're getting sleepy, you're getting tired, you get the signals that you need to stop, and if you don't stop, your body just, like, shuts you down and you pass out.
Right.
Stops you from doing fucked up shit. Exactly.
What Four Loko does is kind of delay that reaction so that, you know, the caffeine keeps you up, keeps your body from, like, telling you that you're intoxicated. And so after you've consumed, like, two or three of these things, which a single Four Loko is equivalent to five regular-sized drinks...
Jesus.
That's bananas. Yeah.
So if you've consumed two or three Four Lokos...
You should be blackout drunk.
You should be blackout drunk, right. But you won't be. And so what happens...
You'll be jumping around like a crazy person and dancing and doing all sorts of things that you would never do in your normal drunk.
You'll basically have alcohol poisoning awake.
Until the caffeine wears off.
Right. And then
when you get the drunk crash and the caffeine crash all at once.
Right.
And nice. I will say Four Loko, precisely because, you know, of its effect and the fact that most people drinking Four Loko won't be aware of why it's not, like, how it's working within their bodies. Like, you know, that does make it a little different than, you know, a Red Bull vodka. Like, a Red Bull vodka is ultimately just a single drink.
I will say I came into this podcast totally against a Four Loko ban. I am now totally for it.
You know what?
Because this sounds insane.
I mean, I'm going to go straight Darwin on this one and say, if you really want to drink, like, four Lokos, fine.
I'm still against the Four Loko ban, but I don't think it's entirely unreasonable.
Right, I mean, but it's
caffeine and alcohol forever.
Right,
you know,
right.
As long as there's been both of those.
I mean, there's some things that are both legal, right?
Right,
I mean,
like, right. So the problem is sort of volume and, like, percentage of alcohol. Like, if Four Loko were, like, you know, 8% alcohol per volume, it wouldn't be as bad. If it were, like, you know, 5%, like a, you know, like a, one of those, like a Mike's Hard Lemonade or something, it wouldn't be that big of a deal.
But I haven't had that in a long time.
It's the fact that, like, this is a strong drink.
Right.
And a lot of it.
Several strong drinks.
Several strong drinks.
Yeah, that's a lot of alcohol.
I mean, I don't think the one time I've had more than five drinks in a night, it did not end well.
The one time?
Wow, you have not had enough.
I'm a pretty moderate drinker.
Wait, that's abnormal? He had five drinks once? That sounds like a lot.
It is a lot.
So you guys,
this is more illustration of the problem with, like, young drinking culture.
I think this is more illustration of the problem with Monica and Nicole. Is it like the one time you had five drinks?
I'm gonna sit over here with my glass. Yeah, I was like,
Nicole's being mad.
I can't tell you about the times I had more than five drinks
because you don't remember them.
Exactly, because I went to sleep, which is what nature wants you to do.
Absolutely.
I just, as a general rule, get really nervous when people start banning food and start banning drinks for whatever reason, because they think that it's dangerous or because, you know, they don't want certain people to buy it. Just because I feel like, number one, it's almost always a slippery slope. And number two, people are, I think, as we all know and has been demonstrated a number of times on Post Budgie and on a million other blogs, people are extremely sensitive about food and what they eat and drink. And when you tell them that they can't have this, no matter what the reason, it could be a reason that they actually agree with. But at the moment that you tell someone no, it feels like it's passing judgment, and the hackles go up, and it just makes it that much harder to make the case for banning it for whatever reason. Like, if you don't want someone to eat cheese because it's too fattening.
Cheese.
At the moment. Well, that wouldn't make any sense.
The FDA. Wasn't the government actually pushing?
No, that is not.
No, that was not a true story.
What?
Wait.
No.
Okay. Yeah.
No, it's fine. Let me finish my thought and then we'll go back to that.
Okay.
I just, the hackles go up. If you don't want someone to eat cheese because it's too fattening, the moment you tell them you shouldn't eat cheese because it's too fattening, like, they just hear the "you shouldn't" part and the rest of the message gets drowned out because the hackles go up and people are just like, well, you can't tell me what to do. Like, it's a very personal thing, which is why it's so hard to make the case for a ban for whatever reason. As far as the FDA thing goes, so the story in the New York Times...
Let me just say one quick thing about Four Loko. The last thing I'll say is the reason I'm uncomfortable with the idea of the ban is that it really seems like banning one product, which is wrong.
Right. It's
yeah, there's Four Loko. There's also, like...
But juice. It's called juice. J-O-O-Z. So it's Jews. It's not even juice. So you can't... You're going to ban Jews? We cannot let our government ban Jews. I'm sorry.
We should just call it drink.
I would create an alcoholic caffeine drink just called drink.
Drink. You had to say drink. My mom says drink. She's like, she pulls over at the grocery store and is like, y'all want some drink?
You remember Nelly had his own beverage, Pimp Juice?
Yes.
He had a beverage.
Yeah.
I would drink it.
Remember Nelly? So, okay, so where's the cheese?
So the deal with the FDA and the cheese is there's a big story in the Times basically saying that our tax dollars were being used by the U.S. Department of Agriculture to promote cheese and to get companies like Domino's to heap more and more cheese on their products. Monica, you're going to have to help me out with this because I remember sort of why it's wrong, but I don't want to get the specifics wrong. Basically, what happens is that there is it's like the Dairy Advisement Board, I think.
Yeah, that's right. It's like the marketing arm of dairy producers.
Right, and basically all the USDA does, so if you are a dairy producer, you pay an X amount of dollars to this board. And what the USDA does is sort of make sure that everyone pays into the system and regulates it to, like, make sure that it's fair and that, like, you're paying the proper amount. And, like, that's it. They don't have any...
Well, they work to sell American dairy products overseas. They work to increase exports. But the idea, which was, like, alluded to in the article, though it was never really stated, your tax dollars are not going to sell you more cheese. Like, that's the ultimate takeaway.
Right. They're that was hinted at in the... overseas more cheese, just like they go to sell people overseas more of whatever it is that the United States
is made in America, yeah. But it's not your tax dollars. It's dairy producer taxes that are collected in an association that is regulated by the USDA.
Okay.
Like, the USDA has to tell them whether their marketing things are okay.
Okay.
But it's not like your money is going to feed you shit that's bad for you.
I'm actually glad that you brought that up because that got lost in the article, and I feel like
I will say this:
the internet now, people know the truth.
Domino's pizza is really gross.
It is.
That was
disgusting.
Actually, like, high up in the article too. I think it was like Domino's pizza, like, rated the second worst pizza in the back. And it's like,
now
that's
that
rough,
we've talked
damn.
About banning things that are bad for you and Happy Meals and Domino's pizza, I'm just going to go ahead out there and say that I really like the Domino's cheesy bread. And I'm not ashamed to admit it.
Never had it. I will say that.
It's like a giant, cheesy, sort of garlicky breadstick, and there is nothing wrong with that.
Sort of like bread.
When I lived in Connecticut, I was lucky enough to live behind the best pizza place in the world, and I used to go get a slice for $2 a day. I really miss it, actually. If I could order that pizza, Belltown Pizza in Stamford, Connecticut. Shout it out. If I could order it right now, I would.
Okay, we should, because we are a little pressed for time, so everyone should do like a quick 30-second shout-out. The three of us, Jamel unfortunately can't come with us, three of us are going to see Harry Potter.
Oh no,
we're taking little kids in our life to go see Harry Potter.
Yeah, that's what I was going
to
say.
We kept them up till midnight so that we could take them to see Harry Potter.
We're not going to see it on our own.
No, not at all.
Okay,
I'm
not
ashamed to admit it.
I mean, like, people are writing about J.K. Rowling for the New York Times.
We are pressed for time because I'm very insistent that we get to the theater really early to go and see Harry Potter.
Absolutely.
Because I'm really excited about it, and that's my shout-out.
I just want to say, just because we're talking about Harry Potter, that Hermione does everything. Harry needs to stop whining. It's every book is like, Dumbledore pours Harry's or Hermione aside, like, listen, you're the only person I can trust. I need you to do X, Y, and Z. And Harry's over here like, oh, Sirius, oh, my dad, oh, my mom, what am I going to do? And it's like, come
That's
on.
The worst
and
Hermione,
that doesn't, I don't care. Hermione does all the work. Every book at the end.
Dude, this is every story in the history of the world. The woman does all the work, and the man gets all the credit.
And then, I guess, Ron Weasley is supposed to be comedic relief, although he's never funny. He never does anything remotely, like, chuckle-worthy.
What's your shout-out?
I think the only reason why you care about Hermione is because she's played by Emma Watson.
Let's be real. Emma Watson is really hot.
See, I think I'm just getting old, but she seems like a baby to me.
Yeah, she's... Yeah.
See, I'm only 23, so this is...
Yeah, Jamel, totally in your Jamel is allowed to... Yeah, I would agree with Jamel, but I feel like a dirty old man.
So I have a real shout-out that has to do with me. I am the cover story for the American Prospect this issue.
Yay!
Yes, congratulations.
It's called Green Job Search, and you all should read it. Primarily, you should read it so that I can see the numbers go up on the statistics on who's reading it. But also because I worked really hard on it, and I would like you to read it.
You should tell them what the story's about, actually.
Oh, it's about how we're training workers for green jobs that don't really exist. We haven't insured a market for green jobs by passing the kind of climate change policy that we need to pass. So in the meantime, all these community colleges are trying to train green workers for green jobs that we haven't insured will be there long term.
On that same note, I have my first print piece in the American Prospect. Called the Judicial Vacancy Crisis, about how the Obama administration has done very little to actually nominate judges for vacancies on the federal courts, and why this is really terrible for progressives in the long term.
I'm just going to also shout out long form journalism in general, because I think, like, Jamel and I both work, like, really hard on these pieces, and we probably get less readership in the print magazine than we do on the web.
Almost certainly,
and I think the work that I do for the print magazine, I won't speak for Jamel, is really valuable, and so it's hard to balance those two things. So please read Green Job Search online.
Okay.
How about let's shout out the fact that this is the first sort of post-bougie podcast where we're all in the same place.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that is really exciting.
I feel like it's funny because I talk to y'all so often that when I listen to the TAP podcast, which is often Jamel and Monica are on, I always feel like it's just a conversation happening in the other room. You know what I mean? Like, it's just the same people I end up talking to all the time anyway. You know what I mean? Just, like, in my computer. So I guess it sounds a lot like that, but a little bit blacker.
I mean, not that much blacker.
Yeah, except for Monica, I should say.
It's true. I'm not black.
So I guess, actually, I should shout out I ran the New York Marathon. A couple weeks ago. It was, like, one of the greatest experiences of my life. Like, I can't really, I keep talking about it, kind of obnoxiously, I imagine, but it was an amazing experience. Monica shout out running a couple weeks ago. I won't shout out running again. But if you have a chance to run, not a marathon, obviously, because those are hard to do and blah, 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 and you don't have time. But, like, if you have a chance...
No, don't make that argument, because you've been explaining to all of us about how we have time and can make it happen.
No. So you have time to enter into a race of some sort. A 5K, a 10K, a 10-miler, whatever it is. Like, you can do that. Those things are great. They're a lot of fun. They give you free shit. You get to be around cool people. Runners are nice people. I don't know. Just because you're a runner means you're some kind of crazy optimist. People are just really friendly. If you have a chance, look up, you know, your local races in your town and run a race sometime in 2011.
I'll also echo the New York Marathon in particular, though, because I tried to watch Gene twice in Brooklyn, and both times I failed. But what I succeeded in was, like, in feeling the particular community that Brooklyn is, and it's amazing. Like, everybody from Brooklyn comes out, and Brooklyn is one of the most diverse places in the country. It's amazing how people come together for this one event. Mm-hmm. I saw lots of kids coming to cheer runners on, even though they didn't know any particular runners in it. There were, like, random trombone players coming out just to play random songs on the street. There was, like, in Bed-Stuy, a DJ playing, like, Biggie on the, like, a few blocks away from where Biggie grew up. Like, the New York Marathon in particular, like, is an amazing experience.
It's amazing.
So if you have a chance to run it or witness it, do it.
I think that's going to be it then. On behalf of Nicole and Jamel and Monica, we will see you after Thanksgiving. Enjoy your food and your colonial massacre holiday. Thank you.
Our theme music is 8 by Aeon. You can catch us at postbougie.com.